Well, welcome to our Michiana Adventist Forum meeting. We're glad to have you all out here on this spring day. Our program is Reinventing the Church for the 21st Century, presented by Dr. Gary Hamill. We appreciate being here with us. He's Professor of Strategic and International Management at the London Business School, along with a bunch of other things that he does. We'll plan to have a short question and answer session following his presentation. Gary Gray will be coordinating that with the mobile mic. Maybe a little abbreviated today since our speaker has to catch an airplane flight. So we'll be winding things up right around 4:30 is the plan today. As we begin, Becky Mays can offer just a word of prayer for us.
Father in heaven, we pause for a moment to invite your presence in our meeting this afternoon. We thank you, Lord, for calling us together as the body of Christ, your church. And we pray, Lord, that you will help us to be good stewards of the gifts that you have given us, that it can go forward in strength. And we thank you, Lord, for our guest, Gary Hamill, today, and for the gifts and the talents that you have given him. And may you continue to bless his work and bless his family. We pray in your name. Amen.
Well, this is our last scheduled forum meeting for this academic year, so we'll be letting you know when we have the dates a little firmer for next fall's presentations. If you are not getting email notifications and would like to, there's a sign-up sheet on the back there where you can put your name and email address, and we'll get you on the list. Just a little bit of housekeeping. Our speaker has requested no recordings today. We will be making a recording, which he'll be reviewing, and we hope that things can work out so that can be on our website eventually, but he has requested that we not make other recordings today, so if you could bear that in mind. I'd like to thank all of you who have contributed during the last year financially to the forum. It's enabled us to be in a position to bring speakers and programs that we couldn't do without your support, so we thank you for it. Well, our speaker today is a well-known management consultant and writer. Dr. Gary Hamill, as I mentioned, is Professor of Strategic and International Management at the London Business School, where he's been on the faculty since back in the early 1980s. He's talking to us about reinventing the church for the 21st century. I suspect that many of you that are here are familiar with his background, and that's part of why you're here, but I'll just mention a few things for some of you who may not be. The Wall Street Journal recently ranked our speaker as the world's most influential business thinker. Fortune Magazine has called him the world's leading expert on business strategy. He's a graduate of Andrews University with a PhD from the University of Michigan. He's written for the Wall Street Journal, has an occasional blog there. One of the entries, which you may be interested in looking up, is kind of related to today's topic, Organized Religion's Management Problem. He's been a speaker at the Willow Creek Community Church Leadership Summit, which they do on an annual basis. His latest book, What Matters Now, just was published this year. He's had other books published in 20 languages, a number of other books, Competing for the Future, Leading the Revolution, The Future of Management, which was picked by Amazon.com as the best business book of the year. And he's written for Harvard Business Review many times, been frequently reprinted there. Other leading financial and business publications, and could go on and on, but our time is limited, and you're obviously convinced that it's going to be a good program. So we'll thank you for being with us, Gary, and turn the time over to you.
Thank you very much. Well, I should start by first saying I'm very honored and humbled to be here. I can tell you when I was a student at Andrews University, no one would have asked me to talk about the church. But boy, did I have a good time when I was here. but I am very humbled. You'll know how unusual it is for me to talk about some of these topics because I'm going to use notes today, just so I don't get anything too wrong. But also, you know, it's a subject that I'm very passionate about. It's close to my heart, but it's not one on which I profess any great amount of expertise. So you're going to have your own views on this. You may agree, you may disagree with me, and I understand that's part of the give and take of the forum. And really, my thinking about this started a couple of years ago when a friend of mine, John Ortberg, who is a well-known pastor and author, Christian pastor and author, he asked me to kind of try to do a mashup between some of my ideas on how do you build organizations that are truly resilient, that can constantly morph and grow and have an impact in the world, but how do you blend that thinking with our thinking about the church? And I accepted John's challenge because I guess like you, I believe that Jesus is humanity's best hope, and I believe that the church is the embodiment of that hope in this world. So how could you say no to thinking about that challenge? And you know, you look across all of the centuries and God's church has lifted hearts and it's satisfied hungers, it's healed wounds, it's mended relationships, it's opposed evil, it's taken on tyrants and poverty and disease and despair, and wherever one finds around the world true justice and a sense of true community, you find at least the shadow, if not the present reality, of God's church. And yet today I would argue that in many ways we are facing a kind of a spiritual tragedy of the commons. There are millions, and I should say my remarks are mostly going to be directed around the church in North America, which I know best, but there are millions who are benefiting from living in a society where the ripples of the church rampant are still being felt. And yet I would argue that we have all this inherited spiritual capital that makes our society more or less fair, more or less just, caring about the weak and so on, but that spiritual capital, I think, is declining. And we are using that spiritual capital up without refreshing it and replenishing it. And I absolutely believe that if the church loses its influence in society, we are all worse off for that fact. Viktor Frankl, the famous Austrian neurologist, psychologist, he said, and I believe it, he said, human beings cannot live in an existential vacuum. And in the absence of some sort of transcendental purpose, human beings will be bored and cynical and selfish. And if that doesn't describe the postmodern society, I don't know what it does. Bored, cynical, and selfish. So, you know, and I believe that Jesus has a cure for that. So I've spent most of my life working with very large corporations, organizations around the world. And my lack of theological training will probably come through in many different places. But I guess whether you have a sacred organization or not, you face the same challenge today. And that is this organization changing as fast as the world around us? And so I wanted to think about that. And even though I don't have a lot of training, I did bother to go out and I read a few books about church, these and a few others. And I can tell you, when I went through the evidence, you know, are we changing fast enough? Are we in the vanguard of the old guard? The evidence on the church is not so comforting. And let me share a little bit of data with you. Since 1990, the number of Americans who claim no religious affiliation at all has doubled. The number of people who describe themselves as agnostic or atheistic has quadrupled. On an average weekend in the United States, only 17% of Americans are in any sort of a religious, Christian service. That's down about from 20% in 1990. In 2006, there were 91 million more Americans than in 1990. 1990, 91 million more Americans than 16 years earlier, and yet no increase at all in church attendance. The Christian brand has also taken a beating over recent years, particularly among young people. When you poll them, most of them have kind of a neutral view of different aspects of the church. But among those who actually have a view, The folks with a negative view far outweigh those with a positive view, particularly when you ask them about evangelicals. That ratio of negative to positive is 16 to 1. And, you know, the de-churching of America might be a little bit less disquieting if our institutions really stood out as islands of spiritual vitality. But again, the evidence is not very comforting on that. George Barna, some of you might know, he started a major Christian polling organization, the Barna Group. I'll refer to a bunch of data they've collected. But in one study, they looked at 100 lifestyle variables, and they tried to distinguish between Christians and non-Christians on these lifestyle variables, and only on a handful was there any noticeable difference, like how many Bibles do you have in your home? There was a difference there. But on most of the variables, there was no difference. When you talk to folks, just about everybody knows a Christian, but if you ask, do you see a difference in the lifestyle of your Christian friends and neighbors, most say, no, we don't. There's not a very big difference between their lifestyle and ours. In a typical week, only 1 out of 4 believers will do anything for their neighbors, anything, kind of any outreach, allocate time to serving others, and almost all of that time actually goes to working within their existing church and helping out there. Some church experts, Tom and Sam Rayner, suggest that a healthy church is one that has a conversion ratio of 20 to 1. And that means that in a year, for every 20 members, they bring in at least one new member. That's their conversion. 20 members will bring in at least one new member during the year. By that metric, less than 4% of churches in the United States are evangelistically healthy. Most are not. Most are not even meeting that kind of fairly low standard. According to another large-scale survey, most Christians do not think they are personally responsible for leading people to Christ. In fact, the evidence suggests that the average Christian will not lead a single person to Christ in their lifetime. Now, I don't think that's true of this group. I don't think that's true of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in general. But if you look at Christianity, that's what the data is telling us. And so you think about this, say, well, what should we really make of this data? You know, certainly we're living in a secular world. Certainly it's harder and harder to be a champion for faith. But I think there's something deeper going on. Let me give you a little bit more data. 9 out of 10 Americans today say they have a faith in a spiritual being. 9 out of 10. So we're in a postmodern world, but people have not lost their spiritual hunger. Most still believe that there is some transcendent being that has an influence in human affairs. Less than 10% describe themselves as neither spiritual nor religious. But 30% of Americans say they're spiritual and not religious. Back to the Barna Group, Dave Kinneman is currently leading the Barna Group. And his data says that 82% of young non-believers have been inside of a Christian church. 8 out of 10 non-believers have been inside of a Christian church, and a majority of those have attended a church for at least 3 months. But then when you look at the young people who do decide for Christ, a majority of those will disconnect from their local church within 6 months of making that decision. The most disturbing data of all, though, comes from a recent book that George Barna wrote, and I had the chance to talk to him about this a few months back. It's a book called Maximum Faith. And in that book, he identifies 10 stages of spiritual growth. And I'm not going to unpack all of this. You can read this. But starting from really with no spiritual understanding at all to a very deep, other-focused love of humanity with the Spirit working through you to the community around you. So he went out and he talked to thousands of Christians, huge survey, and he wanted to understand how far does the average Christian, how far have they gone on their spiritual walk? What's their degree of spiritual maturity? And he found that only 11% of Christians get beyond stage 5, where they've experienced the kind of deep spiritual discontent that leads you into a much deeper relationship with God. They've experienced the personal brokenness that you need to open yourself to God's influence. And less than 2% have ever really gotten to a fully mature relationship with Jesus Christ. So you look at all of that, and you know, you can go back and argue the data. I'm not going to do that now, but you ask yourself a question. Is the gospel failing us, or are our churches failing humanity? Is the problem with God's message, or is the problem with our methods? By the way, those aren't rhetorical questions, if you didn't get it right. I don't think the problem is with God's message. It's eternal, it's immutable. But while your church and my church and pretty much every church, I think, has a God-given purpose, there's much about what we do that is not God-ordained. It is time-worn, but it is not necessarily effective. Some are effective, some are not. But I think a lot of things are going to have to change. A lot of things are going to have to change if we are going to reverse those trends. And if we are going to go fulfill the gospel commission. You know, I think there are two kind of key yardsticks. I think we have to measure the impact of any church program, any initiative, two key yardsticks. The first is spiritual engagement. How effectively are we engaging with individuals who aren't even nominally Christian? How effectively are we reaching them, engaging them, who aren't even nominally Christian? And then number two is not engagement, but transformation. How effectively are we moving people from, you know, down George Barna's scale there, but how effectively are we moving them from a belief in Christ to a life in Christ? And again, if you look at those two metrics, the evidence is that the Christian church, at least kind of in that broad collective sense, the Christian church is not doing so well there. The average church is not a powerful magnet for bringing people to Christ. It isn't a nurturing incubator for fledgling believers. It isn't a potent catalyst for spiritual growth. And there are lots of exceptions. But I think in way too many cases, at least the data suggests, that in way too many cases, church is a weekly convocation of the converted and the content. And that needs to change. Now, admittedly, that's a generalization. It disguises a lot of things. But nevertheless, the data is really sobering for anyone who loves Jesus. And for sure, you know, you could argue that in the last few years, the church has been confronted by a lot of things, a lot of shifts that are almost universally antagonistic to a life of faith. And, you know this list as well as I do. We have a consumer-driven society where the size of your paycheck counts for more than the quality of your character. We have a media-saturated environment that offers us a near infinite number of distractions that lead us away from spiritual reflection. We have young people who have a deeply cynical view of large institutions of all sorts, and that includes the church. A society that is increasingly me-centered rather than other-centered, a reflexive skepticism of anyone who claims to have the truth. This is the world we live in today. And all of those have made life a lot more difficult for church leaders. I don't know if they've made life more difficult for God. I'm not so sure about that, but they've certainly made life more difficult for church leaders. The truth is, though, at least I believe, that unprecedented challenges always bring unprecedented opportunities. And it depends how you look at these challenges. You can wring your hands and you can despair and say how beleaguered we are. On the other hand, think about it this way. Maybe we should feel grateful. Maybe we should feel grateful. That so many people are not merely going through the motions of being Christian. Because Jesus did not have much time for those who are observant but spiritually empty. Maybe we should feel lucky that more than a few scientists seem hell-bent on undermining religious beliefs. Because maybe this will force us to look for a much deeper synthesis between the God of nature and the God of the Bible. Maybe we should be glad that young people have been taught to resist dogmatic statements of all kinds, because this is going to force us to have a gospel that is lived out in action every day rather than simply clever apologetics. Maybe we should be thankful that our materialistic culture has left people hungering for true authenticity, because Christ was the most authentic being that ever walked this planet. So yes, these are problematic, but you know, rather than wringing our hands over the secularization of society, maybe we should be thanking God for our good fortune. And maybe this is God's way of telling us it's time to get out of the holy huddle, right? And time to reach out in a new way. So, you know, some people have described all of these trends. They said that this heralds the end of Christian America. That was a Newsweek cover story a couple of years back, the end of Christian America. Maybe it's the preamble to an amazing spiritual revival. But whether it's the former or the latter, I think depends critically on whether we can reinvent our kind of notion of church and how we reach a hurting world. You know, organizations lose their relevance when the rate of internal change lags the pace of external change. Right? It's a very simple thing. Organizations lose their relevance when the internal rate of internal change falls behind the rate of external change. And today, a lot of organizations are in that boat, and not only secular organizations. You think about the recent history of Motorola, AOL, Sony, Yahoo, Sears, MySpace, Nokia, your local newspaper. All of these institutions have been struggling to keep up with an accelerating pace of change. All of them have been struggling to maintain their relevance in a world where change is shaken rather than stirred. And as I argued yesterday, we are the first generation in history that kind of truly lives in an exponential age, where things are changing at an exponential rate. Not one thing, not a few things. Many things are changing at that kind of pace. And so today, every organization is either going forwards or backwards, but it's definitely not standing still. And so, as I argued yesterday, we find ourselves in a world where the world is becoming more turbulent faster than most of our organizations are becoming more resilient and more adaptable. And I think what's true in business is also true for church. And you know, historically, most business leaders thought their underlying business model was immortal. We'd always be publishing books the same way we published them. We'd be selling music the same way we sold music. Now we know for sure that is not true. These business models are immortal. In the case of church, that business model, that seemingly immortal business model, meant loyal pew warmers who showed up every week, sat passively through the same more or less unvarying service, put $5 in the offering plate as it went by, shook the pastor's hand as they went out, you know, the door at the end of the service, and that was church. Now, obviously, there are paradigm shifts going on within the world of church, with a movement to community churches, mega churches, home church, cell church, online church, whatever follows that. Having said that, most organizations end up shackled to one business model, one way of thinking about how you do whatever you do. And when that way of thinking, when that model atrophies, so does the institution. And so the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, applies to physical systems and it applies to human systems, the social systems. And it's why so often success is kind of a self-correcting phenomenon. And it's why the hard thing, the really, really hard thing, is not inventing an institution or an organization, it's reinventing it. So my starting argument here is really this, that the fundamental problem facing the Christian church in the 21st century, fundamental problem, is not materialism, not atheism, not skepticism, not relativism, it's inertia. That we are in institutions that are not changing fast enough. The power of inertia is so strong in most organizations that it almost always takes a crisis before an organization can really change at its core. This happens in business because you have shareholders that hold you to account. They put management's feet to the fire. If you fail, somebody else will buy your company or the CEO gets ousted. But those forces aren't at work in most Christian denominations. And so you see many, particularly the mainline Christian denominations, they've been holding a going out of business sale year after year, decade out of decade, with very little fundamental change in their policies, their thinking, and so on. And often what you find is you can't get that really deep change without a change in leadership as well. So one of the questions I want to spend just a little bit of time on is, how do you reverse that? Right? So how do you create an institution that can forever outrun change? Whether it's a church, whether it's a business, and there are a few things that I think are very critical. One is you have to be able to overcome the natural human tendency to denial. Every organization is successful until it's not. And the not often surprises people because they convince themselves that things were better than they really are. And the good news, though, is that denial follows a very familiar kind of trajectory. And if you're alert to this, you can kind of protect yourself against it. In fact, let me give you an example of how denial plays out, and I'm going to use an analogy. I'm going to talk for a moment about relationships between men and women. I'm told that men are often in denial about certain things. I don't know if this is true, but I can give you a little illustration. And I can only talk to the men here because I can't presume to speak from a woman's perspective. I occasionally tell my spouse how she's feeling, but that doesn't work so well. if you imagine you're a guy, you're a man, you're in a relationship that's not working very well, a lot of tensions have emerged, communication is getting difficult. The first impulse you have typically is you'll just dismiss the problem. You'll say, well, all couples, you know, they have rough patches. They fight occasionally. It's not all harmony. So this will pass. It's kind of all right. We'll get through this. When things kind of keep getting worse, and now they're harsh words and just this underlying anxiety in your gut all the time, and communication's pretty much broken down, you move from dismissal to rationalization, and you tell yourself, well, clearly there's something out of the ordinary here, but it's certainly not my problem, right? You have a story, and at the heart of the story is something that is completely self-exculpatory. My spouse has issues, right? There's, I don't know what it is, old boyfriend, something at work, but when she deals with that, things will get better. They don't get better. Now you have to go for a drive some evenings to cool down. The children run for cover when voices get raised. So you go from rationalization to mitigation, where you feel now I must really do something here. And you find a quiet moment and you go to your spouse and you say, dear, have you thought about Prozac? That doesn't get you the reaction you were hoping for. So finally you get to honest confrontation, not, by the way, confronting her, but confronting yourself and saying the truth of the matter is, I'm not very easy to get along with, I'm hypercritical, I'm not very patient. Until that changes, nothing is going to get better. Now, I would argue that you see that kind of pattern of denial as often in boardrooms as you do in bedrooms. And I think as Christians, we can be very tempted to take refuge in denial. You think about it. How many church leaders have stood in front of their congregation and shared any of the data I just shared with you? Right? We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to admit it. We don't want to face up to that because we know it is going to challenge some of our deep, deep thinking. Let me get you to listen to here for a moment. This is Reggie McNeil. He's a noted church expert, written a number of fantastic books. Let me just read through one of his, I think, very good quotes. The world is profoundly different than it was at the middle of the last century. Everyone knows it, but knowing it and acting on it are two different things. So far, the North American church has largely responded with heavy infusions of denial, believing the culture will come to its senses and back round to the church. You know, when an organization misses the future, in my experience, it's almost never because the future was unpredictable, but the future was unpalatable. Right? We didn't want to face up to how it was undermining our beliefs. My friend John Ortberg, the way he put it to me, he says, Gary, we have to face up to the fact that we are not living in Christendom anymore. And we have to deal with that reality. So the first job, I think, of any leader is to confront that reality. And it's hard to do because it means admitting that what we're doing now may not be working so well. And it means challenging a lot of our deep beliefs. But I think you have to start there. Let me give you another little bit of data. This is back from Dave Kinneman's book, Unchristian. This is the percentage of young outsiders, non-believers, who believe the following words describe Christianity. So I'll just let you read through that list. I don't need to go through it. But I tell you what, I think we need to share this kind of data with every single Christian. And I think in all of this, we can take some comfort from the fact that even the apostles occasionally found it difficult to accept hard truths. You'll remember the New Testament account where Jesus challenges Peter, says, this very night you're going to deny me. And what does Peter say? Does he say, yes, Lord, I'm a coward? He says, no way, it's never going to happen. So, you know, what was true for Peter is true for all of us. Sometimes the truth isn't the easiest thing to believe. But we have to be willing to face up to that. So to inoculate ourselves from denial, we have to cultivate that unflinching honesty. You have to treat everything you believe, apart from those core doctrinal beliefs, but everything else about how we do church, how we're organized as an institution, what our individual roles are, every other belief has to be treated as a hypothesis that is forever open to disconfirmation. But we can't take any of those beliefs for granted. Second. So first, we have to face up, I think, to that denial if we want to build these sorts of institutions. Second, we're just going to have to try a lot more new things. We're going to have to generate a lot more options in how we do worship and how we do outreach. We can't have programs that go year after year almost indifferent to how successful they are. But, you know, the pace at which any organization, the church included, the pace at which any organization can change is an arithmetic function of how many new things it is trying. And in traditional hierarchical organizations, it's difficult for people to color outside the lines, difficult for them to try new things. And so they clutch at the familiar, the thing that they already know. And you see this kind of arithmetic of innovation anywhere you look. I live in the middle of Silicon Valley, and the way it works there is, if you want to find the next Google or the next Facebook or whatever, you need to get 1,000 ideas from these new entrepreneurs out there. Out of 1,000, only 100 will be worth even looking at. Out of that 100, you may invest in 10 companies, and one you hope will have this huge transformational impact. But you have to start by generating a lot of new ideas. And I'll come back to maybe, if we have time, how we're trying to do that in my church. But I was having this conversation with my brother Lawrence some years back. I'm going to blame this all on him. And I was using this metaphor of acorns. When you walk through where I live, all the oak trees on the ground are literally thousands, tens of thousands of acorns. And you think, well, nature isn't wasteful, so why all the acorns? And of course, the acorns are there because the oak tree doesn't know where the fertile ground is. So the acorns are kind of a search strategy. And some of them will find the right combination of light, soil, moisture, they grow, they flourish. Most of them will die. But you just accept you have to try a lot of things. So as I recall it, Lauren, you can disavow this later, but Lauren talked to me about the way two people make a baby. And apparently, in that process, all but one of about 100 million sperm get wasted. But if the goal is to create a new life, right, you celebrate the one that actually made it, and you say, yay, we're pregnant, rather than moaning all the little guys who didn't. So if you are a secular audience, which you're not, and if I wasn't worried about offending you, which I am, I would tell you that the real problem when organizations stop changing, stop adapting, the real problem is they have a very low organizational sperm count. But I won't say that today. We won't go there.
Maybe they don't experiment.
Yeah, exactly. You said it. Let me give you a few examples of experiments. A church in Los Angeles sends its members out to the campus of UCLA USC. Handing out apology cards, apologizing for the historical sins of the church. One occasionally supported slavery, the Crusades, sometimes the mistreatment of gays or lesbians or others, and so on, but apologizing for not really living up to Christ's example. And they did that because they know one of the primary raps on Christians is that we're hypocritical. Fair or not, but that is the primary rap. Another church in Detroit, one of their experiments, they would send out godly women to buy an hour of a prostitute's time so they could witness to those women about Jesus. I don't know where that ended up on the church budget, but anyway, ministry, I suppose, but anyway. But I think what you have to do and what we're inviting to happen in our church, we have to get every single person sitting in church to be an entrepreneur, to be thinking about how do I leverage the resources, the talents of this church, the people around me in new kinds of ways. In my church, we're literally creating a ministry incubator with seed funding, and anybody can play and anybody can come with an idea, and some of them will be small and insignificant, some I hope not. But to give you an idea of this kind of thinking, I live on a road where on a given weekend we'll get 1,000 bicyclists coming down our road. It's a pretty road through the countryside, and we have hordes of bicyclists. They're not very convenient, and they make you slow down, and they're not very considerate often of the other traffic. So I've had to pray that God would give me a heart for cyclists, and I'd like to remind them that wearing Lycra is a right, not a privilege. But anyway, So I thought, what can I do for these folks? Now, in a church that is really committed to innovation and experimentation, I would find a few other members. We would start to bottle water, get it in something that fits in the cycle, on the bicycle, in those water frames. We would have bottled water out at the end of my drive. We'd make it available. We'd put up a big sign. We'd say, Jesus, hydrating souls for 2,000 years. Put our website on the back. And you start to multiply that 100 or 1,000 times over, and you start to have a bit of an impact. I think a third thing that's very critical is being willing to question old habits. you know, I'm not challenging about, you know, I'm not talking about challenging our creedal beliefs, but the beliefs we have about how we do church. You know, you think about it, in business, almost every time it is the newcomers that win, not the incumbents. And the incumbents had all the resources. They had people and technology and customers, but it's the newcomers who win. And they win because they don't have all the embedded thinking. They don't have the embedded orthodoxies. They challenge those views. And every industry, every organization is rife with these kinds of orthodoxies. So I think one of the questions we have to ask is, what are the things in the way we do church or ministry or outreach, what are the things there that haven't changed for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? And then when you identify those things, you have to ask the question, are these God ordained? Is this just the dead hand of tradition? And so, you know, believe me, I think there are plenty of orthodoxies to challenge in the world of church. You know, you can question, you know, the orthodoxy that church happens in church rather than a believer's home on a Thursday evening. You can question whether more programs really equal more impact, that going to church is the primary manifestation of a Christian life. That to bring people to faith, we need to market Jesus more professionally rather than live out his commands more completely. That the best way to grow God's community is to plant more churches rather than think of completely different ways of bringing people together in Christ. And I'm not saying we should jettison all the practices that these beliefs represent, but we sure need to examine them. Let me show a little picture here. This is a church that won't look like a church. This is a church in Washington, D.C. It's owned by the National Community Church. It's Ebenezer's Coffee House. And several times during the week and then on the weekends in the basement, they run a church service there. But it sure doesn't look like a traditional church. And so, you know, the way I put it is this. When you've been down in the trenches for a long time, sometimes it's easy to mistake the edge of your rut for the horizon. And you start to believe that this is the only way things can be done. You know, here's some silly questions. Why can't we bring our laptops to church? I now mostly take notes on my laptop or my iPad. I took out my iPhone in my fairly liberal progressive church. I took out my iPhone to take sermon notes and had somebody give me a sharp elbow and tell me to put it away. What about using an open innovation process to develop the sermon? The pastor puts up a theme for the week. The whole congregation gets to share their favorite verse, their favorite reading, something that's really meant some incident from their own life, and the sermon gets constructed out of that. Why is church a lecture and not a discussion? Right? I mean, mostly it's, you know, most places I speak, people expect to be able to ask questions. In church, you just sit there and, like, nod. Anyway, some of those may seem wacky. They may seem a little radical. But I think it's very, very important to be able to distinguish between form and function. And think about, you know, how do we deliver the function, but with maybe in a different form. My wife is a member of the leader in the Bible Study Fellowship. I don't know how many of you folks know this, BSF. It's quite an amazing institution. On any given week, they have about 250,000 people in the United States, women and men. They have different sessions, but in hers, the women. Women will come together. 5 or 6 hours of Bible study through the week, then a whole morning together praying, studying the Bible. So hours a week that they're leading these people into deeper awareness of God's truth. They do this 250,000 women a week with a paid staff of 30 people. I know churches who have bigger staff than that with a whole lot less impact. So again, if you look at over the last decade and look at all the innovation that's going on in the world of church, Campus Crusade for Christ, Bible Study Fellowship, the Jesus Film Project, World Vision, Alpha Course, Passion Conferences, almost none of these things come out of traditional churches. And so we need to change that. One of the last things, or the last thing I'd really like to talk about is just kind of a general challenge, I think, for all of us, is I don't think we get this kind of revitalization of our churches in traditional top-down power structures. I just don't think it's going to happen. I talked about this yesterday. If you look at almost any institution around the world, it corresponds to a structure that kind of looks like this. It's true of the Adventist Church. It's true of the Anglican Church. It's just kind of universally true around the world. And yet I will argue that bureaucracies, and that's what this is, bureaucracies are not very resilient. When you concentrate the authority for setting strategy, for setting direction at the top of a pyramid like that, you give a very small number of people the ability to hold that institution's capacity to change, to hold that hostage to their personal willingness to adapt and change. So they become the gating function on the capacity of that organization to adapt and to change. You know, I told a little story yesterday in my talk. I don't know how many of you there, but I told a little story about Bill Gates at Microsoft. You know, amazingly brilliant individual. But over his last 20 years of his tenure at Microsoft, Microsoft was late to almost every trend in its industry. Late and late and late. And he was the chief software architect. But he had a mental model that was based in the past, that was based on personal computers and productivity software. It wasn't based around the web. It wasn't based around these new portable devices, software as a service, and so on. So if you had to get his permission to try something new, the organization was going to get stuck. And so, you know, you simply, and there are many examples. I won't talk about them today because we actually don't have time, but there's a lot of examples of amazing new organizations that are not based on that old pyramidal model. In fact, think about it. All of us who are over about 30, 35 years old, and all of us back through all of human history, every institution we encountered was hierarchical and pyramidal. It was true of church, it was true of work, it was true of government, and now you have the first generation in history whose primary social reality is not hierarchical. It's called the web. And on the web, every idea gets to compete on an equal footing. Nobody's idea gets a free pass just because you have some credential, you're more senior. And sometimes that means chaos, but in general, the best ideas rise to the surface. What matters there is contribution, not credential. When you put something on YouTube, nobody says, did you go to film school? They said, was it interesting? Was it good? All of the hierarchies you find on the web, and there are lots of hierarchies, go to any discussion forum, any site on the web, you will find people have more authority. Their comments are more highly rated. So there's all kinds of hierarchies of influence and authority on the web. All of those hierarchies are built bottom up, not top down. And I talked yesterday about an example, and I didn't pick it randomly, an example of a small Anglican parish in the UK that ran an amazing experiment in this 500-year-old institution. A young new church pastor, assistant vicar, who was very dissatisfied, even in their small church, with kind of this top-down model of church where, you know, the clergy, the professionals, they define the programs. We're going to have a children's program in this ministry. So the kind of that left-hand thing, the church defines the programs, asks individuals to show up, to contribute, to volunteer, to give. And he said, this is clearly not working. The question is, how do we unleash the natural leaders within this congregation? The answer they came up with was they call them mission-shaped communities, but communities of 10 to 50 people where somebody from the congregation, lay leader, led those communities. It was a combination of worship, a combination of missional outreach, Bible study together, but in 18 months, they grew their church from 500 to 1,600 people. He would ultimately write a book about this experience called Breakout. Christianity Today rated it kind of the number one new book last year on church growth, pastoral care, and so on. Amazing story. Again, I have not enough time to go in. It's in my new book. But we need to rethink our organizations. And we're going to have to, I think, turn them upside down. And you know what gives me some help, some hope in doing all of this? If you go back and you look at the early Christian church, it looked a lot like what I'm describing. Let me share a couple of quotes and one last comment, and then we'll take some questions if I can find. I want to share a last couple of quotes. This is Jim Henderson, an expert on Christian evangelism, and here's what he said in a book called Jim and Casper Go to Church. And it was a very interesting experiment he did. He would take atheists, agnostics, and he would bring them into a Christian worship service and then just ask them what they thought at the end. And many times he'd have somebody sitting next to him and they'd be watching some part of the service. They'd say, really? Is that what Jesus asked you to do? They were kind of perplexed by what they saw. But this is one of the things one of the quotes out of his book. I just want to go through this with you. Christians have bought the lie that Christianity is supposed to be in the religion business when a simple reading of the Gospels reflects nothing of the sort. In fact, what Jesus talked about looked more like Habitat for Humanity or Alcoholics Anonymous, more like a grassroots movement with no official hierarchy, but lots of leaders, no offerings, but enough money to get the job done. Jesus called it the Kingdom of God. And in a similar theme, Frank Viola, he's a leader in the house church movement, also very, very prolific author. The church should not be confused with an organization, a denomination, a movement, or a leadership structure. The church is the people of God, the very bride of Jesus Christ. You know, I've said that I think the problem with organized religion is not so much the religion part, but the organized part. And, you know, within the Roman Empire, the Christian church grew from a comparative handful of believers after Christ's death to 31 million adherents by AD 350, about half the population. And that early church was communal, unstructured, non-hierarchical, organic, and on fire. And I think it was the world's first viral organization. And you think of what Peter or Paul would have done with the internet. It was communal, it was organic, it was biological, and it was institutionally weak. It could not raise an army, right? Couldn't build great edifices. It was institutionally weak, but it was spiritually powerful. I think today so often you see churches that are institutionally powerful and spiritually weak, kind of the opposite. And the only way to change this, it's not just about methods and programs. I think the only way really to change this is to rethink our organizational model. And what they did at St. Andrew's and what is now an experiment in our church, more and more churches, is really turning that whole thing around, saying, how do you start with individuals? How do you get them in communities? And the church is nothing more than a community of communities. So let me say one or two quick things. I will finish here, but one or two quick things. I think about this next generation, as I said, the first generation whose primary social reality is not a hierarchical organization. I see in my MBA students, they don't want to go to work anymore for companies that look like that. They don't want to work for General Motors or Procter & Gamble or Shell. They want to go to a social startup. They want to do something entrepreneurial where they can make a difference. And I ask myself, if those people don't want to work in companies that look like those old hierarchies, why would they want to worship in a church that feels like that? And I don't think, you know, they really do. So when I spoke at Willow Creek a couple of years ago, I ended by, and that was mostly church leaders, about 7,000 church leaders, but I ended with this question, which I'll leave with you. I asked them this: are we more committed to redemption, renewal, and reconciliation, the work that Jesus called us to do? Are we more committed to those things than we are to our programs and our policies and our practices of kind of just doing church, right? We're really good at doing church. I don't know that we're always that good at doing Jesus. So where are we really committed? And if we are committed, as we'd all agree, if we are really committed to redemption, renewal, and reconciliation, what would be the test of our commitment? How would we know if we were really committed? And I think one of the tests would be that we would be willing to sacrifice some of those familiar practices on the altar of God's purpose. And I remember when the first sermon John Ortberg preached in my church, it's one of the best I've ever heard, and his simple message was, if you want to walk on water, you have to get out of the boat. And I think maybe he wrote a book with that title. And at least as I've tried to think through a little bit of the challenges facing the 21st century church, I realize just how true that is. So I would argue that we need to pray that God will give us the imagination to reinvent the way we do church where that needs to change, that he will give us the courage to take risks for his kingdom, and that he will give us the stamina to see things through even when the path forward is very uncertain and very risky. I think he calls on us to do this. I think it is our challenge as people who care about our faith and care about the success of our faith in the world. So thank you very much. And I think we have time for a few quick questions.
Yeah, keep her a couple of questions, but let's keep them brief. Who has a question? We don't have much time.
Yes.
As our church's leadership is our current leadership has been schooled in the old way of thinking and everything, and we have a pipeline of people ready to replace them. Coming from that thinking standpoint, how do you see implementing your ideas and in a time frame that where this can have an impact on our church?
You know, I think, first of all, I believe this change can start anywhere. So the reason I share that brief example about St. Andrew's 500-person parish outside of London is nobody gave that young vicar permission to do this. And, you know, there was very little that was standing in his way, because the way you change that old structure is you never start by challenging it. You start by doing something different. And you let it gain traction and gain influence and have an impact until it provides just an amazing example. And the idea of what they did is spreading all around the world, a lot more kind of examples like that. So first of all, you don't wait for somebody else to give you permission. You can start with any church of any size or part of a church, and there's a lot of material out there to look at. So I, you know, maybe what I can do later is I can put together, send around a little bibliography of what I think are kind of the really inspiring things that have been read about how do you start, you know, how do you move away or supplant that traditional model. But you don't start by trying to change it from the top down. I mean, I just think that's not going to happen. And that's what I tell corporations as well. It's just, you know, you want to start something with the grassroots. Having said that, I do think that, you know, I sometimes describe this sort of change as being kind of a what I call a Gorbachev problem. When Gorbachev wanted to change the Soviet Union, and he genuinely believed in glasnost and perestroika, he understood that he could not change it from the top. So you also needed pressure from the bottom. The peasants had to want a different life, and they had to become mobilized and try something. And so you want to get, you know, ideally, you have a change in heart and a change in perspective at the top, where those at the top realize, I mean, if they really care about the mission, they really care about making a difference, they understand the old structures are not going to be good enough, that we have to unleash natural leaders wherever they are. We have to turn that pyramid upside down. And I can tell you, it is not rhetoric. There are even some, you know, big global companies that are doing this. But the best of all situations is the people at the top have gotten that message, they believe it, and then you have a lot of experimentation starting from the bottom as well. But I don't think you wait for somebody to give you permission, because you could be waiting, you know, a long, long, long time. Another question?
Let's see if we can get one more.
Yeah, we can have a couple more. Maybe can push it by 5 minutes here. Mm-hmm.
I think an example of some new thinking in regard to the church is what I read in the Adventist Review, or the World Global Issue, that they are going to take a year in listening to the church in regard to, I believe it was every doctrine, and the rewording of our beliefs. And I think it is a powerful thing, you know, when a church begins to re-examine, you know, everything. And I think, you know, as an individual experience for each one of us to rediscover each teaching and how we communicate it.
No, I think, you know, that kind of self-examination, holding things up to scrutiny, I think is very critical. And, you know, that's why I said, I think that one of the primary goals of a leader is to confront the reality that's out there, but also to treat, you know, everything other than those core trio beliefs, to treat them all as hypotheses. They were effective once, they worked once. One of the books I would highly recommend you folks read, if you want to go a little deeper, is a book called Pagan Christianity. And it's the story of where a lot of our traditions came from. And they're not first century traditions, right? And we think, you know, some denominations are more tradition bound than others. I can tell you, we are all hugely tradition bound, and most of them are not first century traditions. And so, I mean, even the idea of the professional clergy, that we would outsource spiritual leadership to a professional clergy, that is not a first century idea. It doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It just means, you know, we don't have to genuflect before that idea. We can, you know, try something else. And I think you're right. You know, I don't want to kind of be seen as kind of blaming, you know, the theological
theologians or church leaders. I'm not. All of us are stuck in the same model. I was stuck in the same model. You know, I went for years, you know, I'd sit in church and wonderful music, amazing preaching. I was a consumer, right? And this was a consumption experience, and I thought it was absolutely worth, you know, the money I put in the plate. And some weeks it was really good, they got a little extra, but it was good. But, you know, and then I was, you know, I spoke at this conference I mentioned, which was very daunting. It's the only time I've been in an audience where everyone is more virtuous than I am. I'm guessing that's not true today, but it was probably true there. And I put up that slide, and I kind of didn't spend much time on it, but I said, you know, we need to go from church programs individuals to individuals in community that goes into church. And a few weeks after I'd given that speech, I got this email from Drew Williams, the person that I talked about and wrote this book, and he said, Gary, when you put that slide up, I wanted to stand up and shout and celebrate, but I'm English, so I couldn't. But he said, I want to tell you what we've got. And so, you know, we are all prisoners of precedent. We are all hostages to the familiar. And I think one of the key things, you know, we have to do is we have to look out on the fringe and see what's changing. You know, we have to look at what's happening with the new missional churches, with the Triple X Church. You can check that out online. You know, there's a lot of experimentation going on. But again, what happens when the experimentation outside the institution is a lot greater than the experimentation inside the institution, that institution's going to become irrelevant. And so, you know, I'm extremely optimistic. You know, if you look at the influence the Seventh-day Adventist churches have, it is all out of proportion to its size around the world. The difference it's made for Jesus is all out of proportion to its size. And I think, you know, it had a unique message and a unique passion. I think, you know, but we have to rethink that in every generation. And I think particularly when you look at the data on this next generation, we are going to lose them if we can't rethink some of this in a really, really deep and profound way. I mean, if I was a leader, if I was any church leader today, one of the things I would be doing, I would spend at least a day a week just understanding how these new social technologies are changing the world. Because if you think about it, that old bureaucratic, back to the Roman army, back to building the pyramids, that old pyramidal structure, that thing has been the predominant organizational form for thousands of years, and it is slowly going to disappear in the way we've known it. And if our churches hang on to that structure, they are going to slowly disappear. I'm convinced of it. So anyway, I am going to have to go. Oh, we have one more question? Okay, one more question.
Are you suggesting that institutional strength is a bad thing? Should Andrews shut down?
No, I'm not. And the subtlety in all of this is finding a way to overcome these old trade-offs. So how do I have size and still have flexibility? How do I have focus without becoming myopic? How do I have efficiency but still do a lot of experimentation? And so we didn't have a chance today to go into much of that subtlety, but I think the organizations, the institutions that really succeed are going to be ones that transcend those either-or choices, and it's going to be very, very hard. We know how to build organizations that are very efficient and very focused and very disciplined, and we know a little bit about how to do things that are very creative, inventive, and experimental. We're not very good at putting those two things together in the same institution. And for me, you know, that is the prize. But, you know, you go back, when Christ talked about, you know, you wouldn't put new wine and old wineskins. There's a message in there. And I think, you know, we have not been anywhere nearly innovative enough about the way we quotes, do church. We have not been innovative enough about the way our organizations are built and structured. And I think you see that reflected in the fact that the North American church is losing its cultural impact. And you see it, you know, you see this much farther advanced in Europe, where the church is, you could almost say now irrelevant to modern life, not quite, but just about. You only hear the faint echo of the Christian church in Europe anymore. I don't know whether we're on the same track in North America or not, but I worry that we may be. And one of the reasons that we haven't, you know, gone down that track, if you think about it, at least my hypothesis is, that in most of Europe you had state religion. They had a monopoly. And we know what, you know, they had AT&T of religion, right? Remember old AT&T? It was a monopoly. And it was a huge drag on innovation. In America, we had a market for spiritual belief. and we had the Mormons and the Seventh-day Adventists and the Christian Scientists and all of these people competing with their ideas, and we hold on to our truths and they hold on to their truths, but all of them competing, having to be relevant, having to have something new to say. And so marketplaces spur a lot of new thinking, but over time, the institution stops becoming internally a marketplace for ideas and experiments, and there's one way of doing things, and it propagates, and people are trained in it. So again, experimentation inside has to come pretty close to matching the experimentation outside. So I think it's an interesting challenge. I would love if the Adventist Church, if Andrews University was at the forefront of experimenting in some of these new ways. And maybe on another occasion when we're a little further along, I'll come back and tell you a little bit about what we're doing in my part of the world. But we are trying to create a church that feels a lot more like a venture capital organization than it does like something ruled from the top. So we'll see how we get on. Thank you so much. Okay.